I'm here with Jack Fenton from the Warwick East Sports Centre, but rather than me introduce you, Jack, perhaps you could introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about your role and your work here at Warwick.
Hey, thanks for having me. My name's Jack, otherwise known as Coach in esports, and I am the head of esports here at the University of Warwick.
Fantastic. And this is an exciting initiative, which I don't know much about, I have to say, and I'm looking forward to finding out more. So for anybody who's new and just found out about our eSports Centre, or even new to eSports, do you want to say a little bit about what is eSports and what's the eSports Centre?
Yeah, and I'm so happy you broke it up into those two sections for me as well, because that's always the best way to go. So esports itself, and I'll define that in a few different ways. And the best way to kind of understand it is everybody's familiar with gaming nowadays in terms of what it is, but there's a big difference between esports and gaming. So esports is the competitive pursuit of video games. So the variation there between that and gaming is that it's games where there's a winner and a loser. So that's the, for an example, you know, you play FIFA or Rocket League and these sorts of things where they're matches, and those are sport-based and they're quite easy to understand. And then those go all the way as far as really crazy and really difficult to understand games like StarCraft, which have, you know, they're a real-time strategy game where some of the games can go on for like a full hour, but by the end of the winner, they normally do it like a best of series. So, and that's what esports is, and it's that competitive pursuit. And the reason why that's so important, and the reason why that's catapulted so fast, is the skills that you learn and also the opportunities around that to then kind of work around it like sport does. So now you have an industry that's growing kind of 10-15% year on year for the last decade, which is crazy growth that no other industry has seen, especially over this last difficult decade. And in that time, you're seeing absolutely enormous sponsorships. You're seeing Visa, MasterCard, Coca-Cola, Amazon, you know, or every single brand, a car brand you can think of, they sponsor an esports team right now. They're on a jersey of a player who's probably been bought for $3 million to transfer from America to Europe to play for an esports team. So this is the kind of stature of it. And that's a quick random drop of statistics to kind of get people excited.
Well, this is interesting. And as somebody who doesn't know a lot about it, I have seen maybe in the last couple of years all of the excitement over the Fortnite competition and the massive amounts of money that were on offer for quite young players. So I can see why it might be exciting, never mind the amount of money involved. But that perhaps would go on anyway. What's the idea of the Warwick Esports Centre? Why have we got one? Why do we need one?
Exactly. So if you zoom out from, you know, the 16-year-old that won the Fortnite Championship and won $2.5 million, and you zoom out from that and come all the way down to little old Warwick University, you're looking at an institution that has created experts in subjects that transfer really well to this area. And, you know, to give a little bit of information about myself, I was a student here in 2016, graduated in 2020 into the pandemic. But when I was a student here, I helped found the Esports Society. I was a co-founder of that club, which quickly became the best in the country for esports. And they compete in a league which is backed by the same organization that organizes all the sports leagues, called Bucks. And while they play in that tournament, they win that tournament year on year on year. So they're actually back-to-back-to-back champions, and they are well on track to win again. And they don't just win, but they also win by a massive margin. So last year, we got about 3,000 points. The next closest team was 2,000 points. But it's not just the skill of the players, it's also how many players there are. So we actually enter more players than any other team, any other university as well. So you can enter as many teams as you want. You can have an A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H team. And we have everything from brand new players to semi-professionals playing in these leagues. And it's all about these individuals who are getting to take part, and they're getting to familiar with the industry. And they see all this money, which I mentioned before, but money means jobs and people driving that. And I think the reason that it's happening here at Warwick is best kind of understood by a little anecdote that I always give. And if anyone's listening to this has listened to me talk about what it is before, they'll have heard me say the same thing. Well, I'm a big football fan. I'm a lifelong athlete. I transferred to esports coaching from sports coaching. And if you think about a sports game, for me, I like to think about a Premier League game. And if you think about any staff member that was involved in the creation of that game, the fact that it happened, if that makes sense, every single person who's getting paid to be there or paid that in that week, those jobs exist in esports as well. And they're increasing and they're growing and they're in really high demand because esports is a new industry. So they need these experts. So, you know, everything from front of house people taking tickets to administrators, you need referees, you need people controlling the technology that's making it happen. And then you have a sports team. Obviously, it can't exist without the team, but a team can't exist without a coach, without a manager, without a nutritionist, a physio. All these jobs exist and are in really, really high demand, particularly psychologists, because they're as important to an esports team as a physio is to a sports team, right? You know, it's all in the mind, it's all in the hands, and all of them in hand-eye coordination, decision-making, communication. A psychologist can help advance that. So the demand for psychologists in these teams are massive. But then you go even further out and you've got broadcasters, you have commentators, you have editors, you have marketers, you need to have esports law experts, because it's massively, you know, we're lacking regulation because it's such a fast growing industry. So we need people to create regulation, but we also need people to negotiate it and also to negotiate contracts on behalf of players when they're being bought out for $3 million and transferring across the Atlantic Ocean, right? That's the kind of stuff that we need. And there's so many jobs and so many opportunities. But then you think, oh, wow, there's all these skills. It's so cool. I want to work in esports. But it doesn't stop there. It's that actually, because it's so accessible and because it's grown so fast, and it's a lot of organizations started in people's households, it's because a lot of this software, a lot of these games are free to play, free to use, and actually work on really suboptimal devices. Like, they call them toaster friendly. And then, you know, your dad could have handed down a laptop to you a few years ago and you could play games to a really high level. You could record that content, you could video edit it, and you could become a content creator. So, and as a result of that, you learn skills that are so essential to so many jobs right now. So, you know, you'll be able to imagine some of the difficulties over the last few years in terms of lecturers learning how to broadcast their lectures, right? Every single gamer knows how to broadcast their games because they want to show their friends their highlights, right? They want to be like, oh, I did this really cool thing.
Of course. Well, this is interesting because I really am on the periphery, but I've seen the rise of services and online delivery mechanisms such as Twitch, which have really grown in a way that perhaps has led the way, as you say, in terms of online, live or asynchronous demonstration of something. And perhaps teaching and learning has come along and benefited from the development of that technology. I'm quite interested there. But also, presumably, Jack, you will think the same, but forgive me, that even if I'm a student who might not end up with a career working in this exciting field, just as people will play football in amateur teams on a Sunday morning, then it's a great hobby and a great social activity as well.
Exactly. And the skills that you get, not just for careers, but just as a human being, are really good. Like, it's really accessible. The playing field is so much more level than sport in terms of, like, you can go in under an alias and not feel the same pressures. You can play on your own quite easily. Like, if I wanted to play football, I'd need to get a bunch of people together. But, like, you know, in a time when social distancing exists, like, that was really hard. That was impossible almost. Lots of people turned to gaming because they realized how easy it was to go online, have this great thing, meet people from across the world, and be part of these diverse groups, all as a result of participating in this as a hobby.
And what do you think about the stereotype of a gamer might be 12 or 18 hours in a dark bedroom consuming pizza and not getting much sunlight or exercise? So is it either real sports or esports, or do the two go together?
So that's where I think the two are one and of the same. You know, they're cut from the same cloth, I think. There's a lot of discussion even within the esports community about whether it is a sport. I like to say it is, but I also respect people that don't think it is. But as long as you respect it as a competitive pursuit, I think it's a really important piece. That one of the reasons we have so I'll talk about two reasons why we have the esports center in an answer to your question. And one of those reasons is having these social spaces, and you go out to South Korea or China or Japan. Lots of people love gaming and they want a gaming computer, but they won't buy one because there's an esports cafe or an esports center on every street corner. I spent 4 months in South Korea as part of my degree. It was where I went on my intercalated year. I did half there and half in industry, which is when I started my professional coaching career. When I was in South Korea, everyone was playing in a PC bung, which is what they call it. Bung translates to room. So it's just computer room, and that's what they call it. And you'd go to one of these and you'd socially play, and that was normal. And there were so many, and the market was so high demand there that it was super cheap as well. You could go pay like the equivalent to like a quid an hour to use this kind of space. And the amount of use you get at that kind of rate is so much cheaper than buying one of these £3,000 computers, right? So that's what we have at the Esports Center. We have computers worth so much money with the best technology literally available. I think that to this day, I don't know somewhere in the UK that has 24 computers as good as ours in the entire country. And we're giving this opportunity to students to come in and use that as a really affordable rate as well. It's cheaper than anywhere else in the UK.
Perhaps I could ask how we can engage with your offer.
Yeah, so the Esports Centre is completely open to the public at all times as well. So anyone can come in, they can pay to play to use the computers. They have a little login system, but that is separate entirely to the uni login system. You make your own login. You know, my name's Coach on there. I log in. I've got some hours in there because I bought some hours, and I go in and I use those up. That's how it works. Open to everybody to come in and partake in the things they want to partake in. The console area in there, so there's a PlayStation 5, which is hard enough to get right now, and a Nintendo Switch, and that's free to use at all times. And that's just to encourage participation casually in the space and for people to see others playing esport games on these high spec PCs and think, oh, I might give that a go. But then also we do bigger than that. So if you're, like you said, a group, you might be from a corporate organization, you might be internally within the university, or you might be a top level esports team. You can hire the center to come down and we can support you however you want. So, you know, your example that you gave, if you were an academic team and you wanted to do some team building, you could come down. One of our expert members of staff will help find the perfect game that you want to play. They'll prep that all in advance. You'll turn up, sit down, the game already there. They'll teach you how to play the game. And they'll run you through that. If you want learning objectives, we can implement those. So if you wanted to do team building, if you wanted it to revolve around communication, we would set you up on games that are easy to pick up and require a lot of good communication to effectively play. There's so many different opportunities. I'll say on a communications perspective, I studied applied linguistics at the uni. I actually wrote my dissertation on esports team communication. I found enormous parallels between high-level medical teams, high-level military teams, and the ability to make decisions to assess risk in that kind of environment is so good. You grow these skills really, really fast, and even just an hour as a team of people who have never played the game before, you'll find yourself coming out of that better understanding the people around you and knowing how to communicate really quickly in really short periods of time. You'll find that there's actually fire departments that are hiring gamers because of that.
Yeah, this sounds great and well worth investigating. What's the best way for someone to find out more about the things that you've just mentioned?
Well, if someone wanted to get in touch, you can go on our website where there's a number of different ways to get in touch. So the contact form on there and we'll get back to you right away. Or you can contact me directly. If you just search, you know, Jack Fenton Warwick, it'll come up. Either my Twitter or my uni email, you'll be able to find that nice and easy. LinkedIn as well, and you can contact us and we'll sort you out. But the website's got everything there for you and more information about stuff you can do, including birthday parties, which is a really cool thing because, you know, what are your son or daughter or whatever doing right now? They're playing games, and what do they want to do with their friends for their birthdays? Do that in person.
Sounds fantastic. Yeah, so Jack, let me ask you, how do you see esports fitting in with teaching and learning?
So I think this is a massive opportunity for every department at the university, and it's something that we're really trying hard to do, especially this year and moving forward, is to integrate this amazing opportunity into different departments. So, you know, you mentioned that we've been introduced really well by Isabel Fisher, and I'm working with her to deliver some esports content as part of the design thinking module on WBS. And I'll be honest, I heard about this and I was like, I don't know what design thinking is. I didn't study business. How can I contribute? And actually, I'm very lucky that she kind of saw this opportunity and said, no, just come in and tell your story and tell them about esports, because so many opportunities in this market. And if it just gets a few business students thinking, and that could be a next amazing spin-off or enterprise. And, you know, that is the department that the esports is based in. So it's great to learn about that. But also, I think beyond just integrating it directly into subjects, it's also supporting careers. So if they're going on placement, you could reach out to us and we could try and connect expert students in certain areas with certain companies that need those experts, but in an esports capacity. And teaching esports to somebody at that point in time is a really essential skill, because it is an industry they could transition into, right? It's like in a lot of degrees, a lot of things you do, you could take a sport module, a module that relates your subject to sport or relates your subject to something else, like in a specific industry, whether that's engineering or whatever. I think that's doable for esports as well, and I think there's a lot of development there. But also more generally, I think the skills that are offered by people in esports are amazing. And I mentioned this in terms of understanding broadcasting and Twitch and things like that, is what we're trying to do from a careers perspective. And to me, this is one of the absolute core parts of why the Esports Center exists at Warwick, is that we'll harness these skills of these students. There's 2000 people in the esports society's online community, right? Take this massive group of enthusiasts and the skills that they're developing and use them to think how good that is and how useful that is. Like, if I've grown up using Twitch, broadcasting on Twitch, done it for like 5-6 years, and I go into a job in marketing where they're like, oh, we're gonna have to deliver a webinar next week, we're panicking, don't know what to do, you can step up to the plate and go, actually, I could run this really easily. In fact, I actually did that, and within a few months of starting some consultancy for the university, after announcing the esports center, and they were like, oh, it's innovation week, we're doing a webinar, this person's going to run it, but we're really, really worried, we don't know where to do it from. And I was like, I have a gaming computer at home because it's my hobby, so I can run a stream, my internet's good enough. I took part in the webinar, I hosted a panel, but I also simultaneously managed the stream and the chat, and I hosted it on YouTube to make it more accessible to the public than having it on a Teams call and all of these different things, right? And you can be innovative and you can contribute, and it's important. And, you know, we're based within the innovation department and with Innovation Enterprise Creative Futures Esports. That's where we are. And it is innovative, and it's promoting innovation within the students, but also within the staff. Like, if people want to come to us and consult on a great way to do a seminar, can we do a seminar in the Esports Center? And can we deliver a extracurricular activity here? Can our first week new cohort mixer be video games to make sure people meet each other and get acquainted with their fellow students? So many opportunities for us to integrate with the uni.
That's great. And out of interest, I really hope I can visit your centre very soon. But can you just give us a description? How many seats have you got there? What facilities have you got in there? So can you give us a quick guided tour of the scale of your setup?
This is 24 state-of-the-art esports capable machines. I say esports capable, but to be honest, I could run this on my staff laptop, a lot of these games. But when you play them on these computers, which have like 3080 graphics cards, which are the best available right now, by the 3090, but then they have some speculative issues because they're so new. So we stuck with the 3080s when we built it. And then we've got these incredible monitors, gaming keyboards and mice. And the monitors, for example, they refresh at 240 Hz, which is 4 times the amount your eyes work at. So you're never going to drop a frame when you're playing these games. So if you're a performance esports person that catches this podcast, like, this is the place to be. But if you just want a glimpse of the future and feel like you're in a space station, then come use one of these computers. But on top of that, we have 3 different breakout areas. We have some sofa seating, some high seating, and some low kind of coffee shop style seating. And that's all for people to come in. You can study in the space, have team meetings there. You can use this as a very social space to meet your friends, maybe play a few games on the console, where we have a PlayStation 5 and a Switch, as I mentioned before. And I just think it all just weaves in together to create a very dynamic space within the university, where you can do everything from study for your next exam to celebrate after your most recent exam.
Yeah, this sounds great. And I think I know where you are, but tell us, where on campus are you?
So we're within the Junction building, which for those who have been around for the last few years is the old sports center. So we're just across from the Oculus and the new Faculty of Arts building. And you can get in really easily if you walk down the ramp next to the Oculus. And if you're ever in that area, you'll see signs up on lampposts, or a little square on the floor with an arrow. Just follow those and you'll be at the esports center. So that's
right. Excellent. And this explains why I've seen the e-scooters outside as well. they must be folks visiting your center.
Yeah, exactly. People have got to get there fast from that lecture, you know.
That's good. Now, this is brilliant. Is there anything else we should say? You've given us a fantastic introduction to esports. You've certainly whet my appetite, and I'm going to be popping down as soon as I can, and I hope that we and others will be able to make use of your service. It's a fantastic addition for Warwick, and great that Warwick is perhaps leading the way. Do many other universities have esports centres?
So there's only three or four other universities in the country that have esports centres. We are the first Russell Group University to do something like this, and also our esports centre works very differently to any other in the country, is that it is publicly accessible. So other universities, it's either part of a course or it's part of a scholarship scheme or something like that. So it's actually really limited access and more or less just for their students, whereas we are using our esports center for a force in the community. So we've been working with Coventry City Football Club, and we're going to be delivering lessons in local Coventry schools about and using esports to teach PSHE, actually. So, you know, obviously one of the things that you talk about, you know, oh, if my son's playing this game, like what's to keep them safe when they're online? We're going to be teaching those sorts of lessons, but also teaching using esports as a way to teach resilience, respect, anti-discrimination, all sorts of amazing topics which are really important for young people to learn. And esports is a vehicle for change. So we'll be in the community, we'll be running great projects. So yeah, very different to anything else any other uni is doing.
Definitely. Well, thanks ever so much for your time today, Jack. I realise how busy you are, but great to meet you and look forward to following your progress and that of the Esports Centre. Thanks again.
Thank you so much for having me.
In the next interview, I speak to Ola Whelan-Davis, who tells us about her previous role in Warwick Foundation Studies and how she used the Padlet tool to assist with pre-arrival information and support. I'm here with Ola Whelan-Davis, but rather than me introduce you, perhaps you could introduce yourself, Ola.
So I'm currently working in the economics department. My role is a student wellbeing and progression officer. However, this role is very new. I only started a week ago. Previously, I was working at Warwick Foundation Studies on the International Foundation Programme, which is a programme for 200 plus international students as a bridging year to an undergraduate degree. And I worked there for 4 years doing UCAS and progression for all of our students.
Excellent. Well, from one very busy role to another incredibly busy one, I'm sure. But I understand that you were making use of Padlet to assist with the process of pre-arrival. So right from the start, what was the idea behind it? What were you doing?
Okay. Yes. So right from the start. So why I developed it really. Is because we developed a need within the department to provide some introductory learning materials and experiences for our international student cohorts prior to them arriving in the UK to start on our foundation programme. And that was really for lots of reasons, to familiarise themselves with the learning experience they were going to move to. So very different, you know, UK HE experience. So that was one reason. We also wanted to try and create a bit of a community of experience for students pre-arrival. And then the other reason, mainly from my perspective and my role, was to get students to think and plan and challenge them a little bit more before they arrived. With their on their future decisions and progression choices. And then we also wanted them to find out and learn a little bit more from the alumni on our programme. So we provided a space to give the alumni a voice to sort of share their views and opinions. Yes. And advice to the new cohort.
Okay, so have you got some examples of the sorts of things that you might be asking these students pre-arrival? What sorts of things were you asking them to do?
Yeah, so it was a mix of lots of interactive materials, I suppose, we sent them. So we had to liaise with our recruitment team So they sent out materials through offer holder web pages, which they produced. So it was a mix of lots of different materials. So information on basic things like what is a lecture, what is a seminar, how to what to expect, the types of modules that you might be studying. So we had some of the teachers make some little videos, just friendly 10-minute introductory videos on what is the module you're going to be studying, which is introduction to finance. You know, what is it all about? So we did little videos.
Could I just interrupt, because the listener might be thinking, well, that sounds good and important, but why not just use a web page? So why use Padlet? What was the advantage, or what were the reasons for thinking of using Padlet?
Yeah. So I use Padlet specifically. So a lot of the other teachers use just stream videos, etc. But I chose Padlet because I liked the sort of interactive feel that it has.
Yeah.
Collaborative feel that it has, and the very user-friendly interface that it has. Also, I thought it was well suited to our students who were all English as a second language.
Yes.
Because you could put the materials in very small, short little posts.
Yes.
Which are much more accessible.
And could I ask also then, what was the element of interactivity? What were the students doing? Were they adding comments, or what did you ask them to do?
So we asked them to engage with listening to some audio that I made. They had opportunities to sort of like or add comments on posts that I put in. They also had a Vivox app that I put on there, where they could ask any questions, and then there was an evaluation form. So it was interactive.
Yeah.
And then I thought that that was a good way to get them.
Yeah, it sounds like it. My knowledge of Padlet, I think, agrees with what you're saying, that way of presenting perhaps bite-sized chunks of information in a sort of aesthetically pleasing and easy-to-find way, and layering that interactivity presumably helped. And do you have any feedback from students, or do you have any lessons learned? How did it go? Anything you would change? Was it a success?
Yes, it was. We did some feedback sessions when they started. We got some groups of students together and asked them what they thought of the resource. Did they access it? How useful was it? And the feedback was good overall. They found they'd never used it before. That was the first thing. It was a very new tool. So I think initially they found it, just because of the newness, how to navigate it. But I think it was because it's quite user friendly, that was not too much of a hurdle. But they enjoyed the interactivity. They enjoyed the little quizzes which I had on there, which were like careers quizzes. They loved the student testimonials which I had. So I asked our alumni to give them some tips and advice. And they enjoyed that, hearing from their peers. And they liked the careers materials I had on there, and the thinking about what skills they might need for future jobs.
And anything you might change or add, or indeed is it something you're taking into your new role and might make yourself?
Yeah, I think I might use it again in a wellbeing context. Definitely, I think there's opportunities there because of the interactivity and the ease of use. Padlet lends itself to all sorts of different scenarios, and you can set it up at the wall in so many different ways.
Yeah.
I think what I would probably do, certainly for maybe different with undergraduates, but for the foundation year students, I think it would have been a good idea to provide them with perhaps some training in their induction week on how all of the different bits of technology they were going to encounter actually work.
Oh, yeah.
Some training, on Padlet, on Vivox, on Teams, on email etiquette. So just a range of different.
Yeah. Perhaps Moodle and Moodle as
and
well.
Moodle,
perhaps,
yeah,
of
Moodle.
Course. Yeah, and that links with what I'd like to move on to and ask you a bit about, because in addition to Padlet, I understand you were also involved in the delivery of online workshops, content, and other sessions. Do you want to say a little bit about your experience? This podcast is aimed at those interested in blended and online learning, so we're still thinking about what we experienced and what we learned from that sudden move to increased blended and online learning. So Do you want to say a bit about anything else you were involved in maybe last year and what the online learning experience was like for you and your students?
Yeah, I mean, it was a challenge, as it was for all education institutions. And I think students and staff found it hard at the start. You know, we were all learning together. And I think it had lots of really lovely advantages and things maybe that we didn't like so much. Things that worked very well were the sort of the ease of the ability to use it, I suppose, and set up meetings very easily, have lots of groups of students attend who may not have attended a live event. So just ease of accessibility. Students all really love all the chat functions when you're in a meeting, you know, and the emojis and the being able to ask questions is really nice. And I think once staff and once I got used to presenting and being aware of my audience, because that's one thing that it's taken away from you when you're on the screen, you can't see your audience.
No, that's
you
right.
You can't get the, you know, the body language, the visual contact of how they're reacting to things.
Yes.
So I think we had to learn how to get some kinds of reactions from
people
we're presenting to in different ways. So instead of looking at them and finding out, we were having to go, well, put a note in the chat or give us a thumbs up emoji or, you know,
using
all the other functions to
Did you go as far as using breakout rooms or any other functionality to sort of recreate what you might do in the classroom?
Yeah, so I've used breakout rooms. I was very scared about them originally.
Yeah.
I can't do this. But yeah, they worked well. I think, again, once you know how to use it, the students found it good.
Yeah.
I think I liked when I was able to go into each breakout room and check out how they were doing and offer my support and then disappear and come back in again. You'd often find that when you'd say, go off and discuss this, when you went into the breakout room, there was silence.
Yeah.
Nobody was discussing anything. So it was kind of then a good opportunity to go in and start a few questions and get them
motivated
and engaged again. So
that's interesting to hear. And one of the challenges, perhaps from last term in particular, when we started returning to campus, were your students physically present last term, or did you have a mix? And did you even have to experience any hybrid teaching where you had some students in the classroom and some students online, or what was happening last term?
Yeah, so we did in our department. I didn't have to deliver that myself.
Yes.
So all of my sessions that I did to big groups were just all online because that was easier for me.
Yeah.
But certainly some of our staff had to do hybrids. So where they had a student, they were delivering an online class, but they had a student who was accessing it through a link.
Yeah.
There were challenges with that.
So, yeah, just think about your new role, Ola. Have you got any plans to use some of this technology we've talked about or other tools to help with your future work?
Yeah, I think I definitely do. Now I feel more able and confident to use it. I can see the advantages of it and the great functionality and accessibility that a lot of it gives to me. So I think I definitely will in the context of the well-being. So in the department that I'm in at the moment, there's not very much happening in terms of well-being. So I would like to initiate some sort of, you know, maybe events, but I also want to use technology to promote these or maybe, you know, have some online things happening,
maybe
have a blog,
maybe
do some little podcasts. I'm thinking about how it can all fit in, but it's something that the department wants to develop. So,
Okay. Well, that's something to watch. As you say, the development of. But just thinking about the well-being side, one of the challenges that many students experienced last year was this loneliness and isolation, and that can be a problem related to online learning. Is it the case that most of your students in economics are now back with us, or have you got a bit of a split, and therefore is that naturally do you think that problem has naturally resolved itself, or do we still have challenges related to the current situation?
I think there are still challenges. So, I mean, the policy in this department is that everything's face-to-face now. Students are expected to be here and attend face-to-face lectures and face-to-face seminars. There are challenges in that some international students haven't been able to arrive, so they're having to have an alternative provided to them. So I don't think the online will ever go away, you know, because we're always going to have backups in case something happens again and we have to switch very quickly back to online. Sure. So students have to be resilient enough and be used to it enough to be able to swap from. I don't think it's gone away. Online learning has not gone away. It's here to stay. But I do think it's a challenge for lots of students. I've only had an email this morning from a student who said that he missed so many seminars and lectures last term because he couldn't cope with online learning. It just wasn't for him.
Yes.
Hopefully this term will work better for somebody like that.
And I'm That's sure right.
I'm alone in that feeling like that. But it's, it takes a lot of getting used to and it doesn't suit everybody.
No.
It's very isolating for students.
That's right. Actually, I mean, again, it might not be fair to dig too deep, but do you know what the challenges might be for students who don't get on with online learning? I mean, we might assume that in the main, it's better for at least some of our learning to be face to face for the social aspect, never mind perhaps the experience. But do you know why some students in particular might not get on with it or might be averse to it? Have you got any idea on that?
Well, the student I was dealing with this morning was on the autistic spectrum and found the whole complicated, how he saw it was very complicated, just being able to access his timetable, using Teams in the right way, getting anxious about accessing the right meetings.
Yes.
You know, loads of little things, and then worrying about the technology.
That's interesting, actually, because I suppose that, the advantage of being physically on campus, particularly if you've got a friend or just somebody you recognise, you can follow them to the right place, can't you? And it's easier to find a physical room, perhaps, and recognise if that's the right place. But I can perhaps understand where some of that anxiety might come from. But that's interesting to hear. And perhaps, as you hinted at earlier, that maybe, certainly the online experience won't go away, but for some students who enjoy the benefits, they might choose more online, and for those students who prefer for whatever reason to stick to on campus, then that might be their choice. It seems like students will perhaps need to get to used to maybe some sort of blend, but that's interesting, actually. So even your lectures are being delivered face to face. They're not being recorded or done online, as far as you know.
They have one asynchronous lecture which is recorded and made available to them, but the other one is synchronous.
Yes.
And they do have a lecture capture which they put on Moodle after if students can't attend, but the policy is they go, the lectures, that particular lecture for each module, face to face.
Is there anything else you wanted to say about either the use of Padlet or any other experiences related to online learning? Any other reflections? You don't have to have any, but is there anything we haven't talked about?
We've all had a huge learning curve.
Yeah.
But thinking back on it, you know, I've enjoyed all the learning. I feel much more knowledgeable and au fait with technology now than I did 2 years ago.
Yeah.
I never would have thought in a million years I would have learned so much.
Well, that's interesting you say that, actually, because I think it is the case that we've got this sudden skills development advantage, you might call it, in that it would have taken us 5 or 10 years to get staff to the point where they were this confident with technology. I think the next challenge is for staff and students with us, but is to think, well, how can we keep that momentum going so that year on year we can say, right, well, you know how to do this confidently, you know how to do that, but how can we develop you in your skills, and what do you need to learn to assist you in your work, is what I'm trying to say.
And using the technology in a savvy way, because it doesn't place, you know, the pedagogy. It needs to fit and align very well with what you want to teach the students.
Exactly.
You can't just use it because it looks cool. And it's...
Oh, no, you're quite right.
So you have to be, I think that's where the challenges are actually.
It is.
You have to use it when it's the right time to use it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There's got to be a clear purpose and justification for its use. And I guess while some students might still prefer for more of a blend and a small number, maybe I might guess, might prefer still to be online. I'm assuming that after a year or two of online learning, that students are appreciating whether they like it, whether they think they like it or not, are hopefully appreciating being encouraged to come back on campus where that's possible.
Yeah.
But I guess your challenge as a working in wellbeing is recognizing that there are students that will appreciate that and students that will have difficulty with whatever mode we're using, I guess.
Yes. I think it's just about being flexible and helping the students to learn the best way that they can.
Sure. Thanks for your time this afternoon, Orla. It's good to meet you and find out about your work.
Thanks very much, Jim. It was lovely to chat, and I hope people have found it interesting and useful for their own work.
I'm sure they will. Thanks again.
Thank you.